I am cautiously optimistic that as we get into the late fall and early winter, we will have an answer, and I believe it will be positive.
The top U.S. expert on COVID-19 expresses his optimism. This is Wednesday, the 29th of July, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, Malaysia's former prime minister is convicted on charges of corruption. You'll hear about the woman who wants to be the next First Lady of the United States. And as much as our lives have gone virtual, a bizarre story about virtual kidnapping of Chinese students in Australia. It is all on today's VOA Asia. The Trump administration says it has signed a deal to get doses of COVID-19 under development. AP's Sagar Meghani reports.
There is no vaccine yet, but the administration's been moving to arrange delivery of ones pharmaceutical companies are working to develop so that they can be quickly distributed once proven safe and effective. Health and Human Services Chief Alex Azar tells Fox News this contract is with Pfizer for the first 100 million doses of its vaccine, with the option for buying another 500 million. Nearly two dozen potential vaccines are in various stages of human testing worldwide. A handful are moving into late-stage testing. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, appeared on the ABC Good Morning America program. He was asked about his assessment of the search for the vaccine.
The phase 3 trial, as you know, started yesterday. The early data on phase 1, which was fundamentally safety, but it was enough for us to see the kind of response that this vaccine induces an individual, and it induced a level of antibodies, which are the proteins that fight the virus, at a level that was quite high in the sense of it was comparable, if not better, than what we see in the recovery from natural infection. And that's really one of the issues when you're dealing with vaccines. If you can induce a response that's at least as good as natural infection, that is a good predictor that you're going to have a vaccine that works. Obviously, the proof of the pudding is you've got to do the trial. It's a large trial. 30,000 people are going to be in the trial. That will give us the answer. And yes, I am cautiously optimistic that as we get into the late fall and early winter, we will have an answer, and I believe it will be positive.
Nearly 4 million Americans have been infected by the new coronavirus, and at least 142,000 have died from COVID-19, the disease it causes, according to Johns Hopkins University. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. The head of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention says he's been injected with an experimental coronavirus vaccine in an attempt to persuade the public to follow suit when one is approved. Malaysian authorities say 26 Rohingya refugees who were thought to have drowned after jumping off a fishing boat and trying to swim ashore to the island of Langkawi have been found alive. South Korea acknowledges that a North Korean defector who had been accused of rape in the South may have sneaked past South Korean border guards before apparently swimming back to his North Korean homeland. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. Malaysia's former Prime Minister Najib Razak has been convicted of corruption related to the multi-billion-dollar looting of a state investment fund. VOA Steve Miller spoke to reporter Zan Azli in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, via WhatsApp about the verdict and what's next.
This first trial involves SRC International. Now, SRC International is a company, it's a subsidiary under 1MDB, 1MDB being the sovereign wealth fund by the Malaysian government, owned by the Malaysian government. And today, the judge has found Najib Razak, former Malaysian Prime Minister, guilty of all 7 charges, which involves money laundering, abuse of power, and criminal breach of trust. And the amount that is linked to this particular trial, it comes to about 42 million Malaysian ringgit, which is approximately about US 10 million. So today he has been found guilty of all 7 charges that comes under this trial.
Yeah, you mentioned that this is, you know, the first of many trials. So, I mean, what happens next? Because I believe he has five total trials in all. So how might this verdict for this subset of charges affect what's going to move forward?
Look, like it or not, from the very beginning, Najib Razak's scandal with 1MDB has been a public affair. It is very much a trial in the public's eyes, in the media as well. And if you remember, Malaysia had a general election in 2018, and Najib Razak, who was the prime minister then, he was leading the National Front, the Barisan National Party at that time, lost for the first time in the history of Malaysia, right? They've never lost the general election. And one of the main contributors to the loss for his party was actually the perception that the public had for the scandal, for the 1MDB corruption scandal that is directly linked to Najib Razak.
Yeah, you mentioned that, you know, this was one of the things that led his party to lose power. With him guilty, does that stand to hold true for upcoming elections as well?
Well, I mean, if you look at the recent past, the recent couple of months in Malaysia, there have been a change in government. After 2018, when Najib Razak's party lost the general election, the former opposition became the government. And in March this year, a few months ago, there was a jump in different members of parliament, and another party now is the government. And there has been talks that there may be snap elections that will be held in, you know, before the end of this year. And if there is going to be snap general elections, I think this will affect the elections, because right now Najib's party, UMNO, is actually now back in the government. And if they're going to have snap elections, I think it's going to affect the party very, very much, the verdict that has happened, that's come out today.
Zan, going back to former Prime Minister Najib Razak, what did the judge decide in terms of sentencing the former Prime Minister?
The verdict was done throughout the whole day, and the sentencing has come right at the end of the day before the court closed. Justice Muhammad Nazlan Muhammad Ghazali has sentenced Najib Razak to 12 years in jail, and fined him 210 million Malaysian ringgit for abuse of power. So he got, it's basically, he's been sentenced to 12 years in jail for abuse of power. He's been sentenced to 10 years in jail for each of his three criminal breach of trust charges, and also a 10-year term for money laundering. But all of these jail term time is will be served concurrently. So he's got a jail term of 12 years.
Reporter Zan Asli in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, speaking with VOA's Steve Miller. Happening now in Asia, Afghanistan's president announces his government will soon complete the release of 5,000 Taliban prisoners, thus paving the way for the start of long-sought-after peace negotiations with the insurgent group. After the end of the speech, the Taliban announced a ceasefire for 3 days and three nights. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. This is VOA Asia. As Thailand's economy struggles to recover from the initial stages of the COVID-19 pandemic, renewed anti-government demonstrations have sprung up across the country. Protesters are demanding amendments to the Constitution, Parliament to be dissolved, and a stop to the harassment of rights activists. The rallies were temporarily halted earlier this year when the COVID outbreak curbed large gatherings. Steve Sanford reports from Chiang Mai for VOA.
So-called flash mobs have gained momentum in Thailand, with more than 40 anti-government rallies organized on short notice since a massive anti-government demonstration was held in Bangkok on July 18th. Tech-savvy students have coordinated these gatherings at a moment's notice to avoid a security backlash. Protest leaders are worried that if they criticize the ruling class, they will be forced into exile, like some activists in the past. Or worse, go missing.
It's a dark path. There's no clear path that we could take because the economy has created this overwhelming pressure for the younger generation to come out and be the leaders to demand all our rights back.
Many of the participants include high school and university students belonging to the groups Free Youth and the Union of Students of Thailand. Veteran activists say the young demonstrators should not be underestimated by the ruling government, who have used words like adorable to downplay the protests.
I see a big difference with this movement right now, that instead of going all the way to Bangkok, you know, they set up groups in local areas, everywhere, everywhere. The advantage is that they can organize people in local areas. They don't need to spend so much money traveling by bus or train or plane to Bangkok.
In Thailand's north, farmers who supported the military-backed Palong Pracharat Party were promised guaranteed prices for their crops. But many have seen these promises broken or at least put on hold since the 2019 election and the coronavirus outbreak earlier this year. Now, some are supporting the protests.
I'm not entirely confident that the student movement will be successful with their protests, but I will support them. I want to see permanent change. I don't want things to go back to the same way as we used to be.
While the rallies gain recognition across the country, the government says it is setting up an extraordinary commission to open dialogue between demonstrators and the government. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Chiang Mai, Thailand.
The mayors of Portland, Oregon, and five other major U.S. cities appealed Monday to Congress to make it illegal for the federal government to deploy militarized agents to cities that don't want them. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker has more.
This comes as the feds say they will stay in Portland and possibly deploy more agents until the U.S. courthouse is safe. Last night, a few protesters set off firecrackers and tried to climb the fence in front of the building. The feds deployed tear gas. The mayors of Portland, Seattle, Chicago, Kansas City, Albuquerque, and Washington, all cities where President Trump has sent militarized agents under Operation Legend or threatened to, sent a letter to lawmakers saying the administration's egregious use of federal force on cities over the objections of local authorities should never happen. I'm Julie Walker.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Floods caused by heavy monsoon rains in two of India's poorest states have displaced or affected 8 million people and killed 111 since May, at a time when coronavirus cases have swelled there. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, many Japanese fishermen have made the decision to sell their products online rather than locally in person. The change in consumer demand has brought new opportunities to Japanese e-commerce industries for fresh products. With the majority of business already going online, suppliers of perishable products are no exception with measures taken to maintain social distancing. 45-year-old fisherman and seafood company owner Hashimoto Jun has experienced firsthand the impact of the epidemic in Japan.
Our seafood orders were basically cut off because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Most seafood shops where orders used to come from were closed, so the sales dropped badly.
Fortunately for fishermen, there is still a demand for seafood on the internet, and for some, this is an opportunity to even expand their businesses. E-commerce platforms are replacing local street shops to become the most common business venue. Hashimoto doubled down on this online market by giving lessons how to cut the fish through live streams.
See, this sound of a knife scratching fish bones can be the sign of a nice cut. I want to show people that this is an activity involving not only hands, but also ears.
This new business model has increased sales with registered users of the e-commerce platform where Hashimoto Jun is based, pushing 200,000 from 50,000 before the pandemic. Takahashi Hiroyuki, CEO of e-commerce platform.
The direct supply from producers to customers will become an ideal mode of retail when unpredictable situations like now occur. Given that Japan is a disaster-prone country, we hope to promote such an online business model.
After 6 months of a nationwide shutdown, hundreds of movie theaters have been reopened all across the country in China, but with added safety precautions that have altered moviegoers' experiences. Face masks, glass screens at counters, and temperature checks are not the only differences with the reopening. Ticket sales are now only available online, and 30% of tickets are allowed to be sold per show. Most theaters also require at least a 2-seat gap between viewers. Despite all of the new policies, this did not discourage 25-year-old human resources worker and movie fan Liu Yonggao from returning to the movie theater.
I'm very excited. I haven't watched a movie in more than half a year, so I just decided to take the day off and come experience it.
Prior to the reopening of an outlet of the SFC chain, one of China's largest movie theater franchises had the whole building undergo a thorough cleaning. The cleaning staff used disinfectant soaked cloths to wipe down seats and 3D glasses. The cinema's manager, Bo Yaopei, said viewers had been calling regularly asking when it might reopen.
Audiences have really been looking forward to this, to be able to enter cinemas, to sit together with others, and feel the happiness that movies bring.
For Business Scene, I'm Ira Mellon.
A message from your friends at VOA Asia. Can the coronavirus survive in cold weather? Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you're sick or advised to by local authorities. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Mellman. Jill Biden, the wife of the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, is on leave from her teaching job to assist with her husband's campaign. Mrs. Biden is very familiar with life in Washington, since her husband spent 36 years in the U.S. Senate and 8 years as vice president under Barack Obama. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti brings us more interesting facts about Jill Biden in this profile.
It's been Joe's faith that really has gotten him.
This is Jill Biden these days.
And that's exactly what my husband Joe is going to do.
Holding virtual campaign rallies for her husband. This one to a group of Latinas. A day later, Zooming at a community college.
Hi, Erin.
A forum near to her heart.
I'm Jill Biden, and I'm honored to be a community college professor.
Jill Biden became the first ever second lady to hold a paying job outside the White House while her husband was vice president.
Many of my students don't know that I have two jobs.
At her college's commencement, she told the story of a student who ran into her classroom saying,
Dr. B, I saw you last night on the television with Michelle Obama. And I called my mother and I said, Mom, there's my English teacher. And she said, that's not your English teacher, that's the second lady.
If Joe Biden is elected, Jill Biden would be the first presidential spouse to have earned a doctorate. Betty Boyd Caroli wrote the book, First Ladies.
I would expect her to be very active in suggesting specific reforms to the education system. But not everybody agrees. You know, many people would like a first lady who keeps her mouth shut and is seen only in the very best clothes. I'm not in that school. I really think it's a powerful platform.
Life with Joe Biden started out complicated. She was going through a divorce. He was grieving, raising two young sons alone after his wife and baby died in a car crash. Jill and Joe married after Joe asked 5 times.
And the 5th time, I finally said to her, I said, Jill, my Irish pride has gotten hold of me. It's the last time I'm going to ask you. I said, you don't have to tell me when you'll marry me, just if you'll marry me. She said, yes.
And 4 years later, Jill gave birth to a daughter. Tragedy would strike again in 2015 as Joe Biden's son, Beau, died of brain cancer.
This is personal for me and for my husband, Joe.
So Jill Biden added cancer initiatives to her list of causes.
So should we read?
Sure.
In June of this year, Joe Biden wrote a children's book.
Not only did he lose his fear of public speaking.
about her husband's early years, his competitiveness and resilience after being mocked over his stutter. Although they call the tiny state of Delaware their home, Jill Biden has followed Joe through his last 21 years as a U.S. Senator on Capitol Hill and 8 years in the White House, where she'd like to return for at least four more.
Buenas tardes, comadres.
Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, Washington.
Make sure you join us tomorrow on VOA Asia when Carolyn Presutti profiles the current U.S. First Lady, Melania Trump. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. News from Australia, where New South Wales police Monday warned students of Chinese background studying in Sydney to be aware of a virtual kidnapping scam that has obtained millions in payments from unsuspecting victims. Reuters' Gloria Tsol reports.
Video released by Australian police Monday shows a disturbing sight. What appears to be a person with hands and feet bound and tied up in what police are calling a virtual kidnapping scam targeting Chinese students in Sydney. Police say the scam has already obtained millions in payments from unsuspecting victims. New South Wales official Darren Bennett explained the scam to reporters on Monday.
The offence types are very disparate in their range. They can form the intent to create a scam kidnapping where people communicate to their family overseas and pretend they've been kidnapped on instruction from a fraudster ringing them on the telephone.
Scammers call up the victims they plan to target, claiming to be from a Chinese authority like the police or tax department, according to the statement released by the NSW police. The caller then, quote, convinces the victim they have been implicated in a crime in China or that their identity has been stolen and that they must pay a fee to avoid legal action, arrest, or deportation. Bennett called the crimes, quote, egregious and very cruel.
A recent one that we've had was essentially threatening harm against people, family members in China, unless they contrive a photograph that makes them look like they've been kidnapped. Then they encourage the person to lock themselves away in a hotel room, turn their phones off, cease all contact. So the people in China have got a two-pronged threat. They've got this photo of their loved one and they can't get in touch with their loved one.
Bennett also warned that the phone calls are becoming very common and encouraged anyone receiving one not to fall for the scam.
Reuters' Gloria Tsol reporting. This is VOA Asia. As businesses start to reopen, some are turning to technology to figure out how to make workplaces safer. Michelle Quinn reports on the trade-offs.
Before the pandemic, this sensor mounted over a door had one job. Let building managers know how office space, bathrooms, cafeterias were being used. Now that information is helping companies figure out how to make workplaces safe.
There's a sensor that gets mounted above a point of entry, and as people enter and exit, we use infrared laser light and a whole bunch of really cool algorithms to both generate and analyze depth data. And that depth data gives us a really clear understanding of how many people enter and exit a space.
Companies are turning to technology like this as they try to figure out how to get people safely back to work. Drones that monitor from the air, social distancing, and face mask wearing. Wearable devices that buzz when employees are too close for too long. The pandemic has accelerated employers' experimentation with tech in the workplace.
We really need new experimentation, especially around worker health and safety. But we have to tread really carefully here because otherwise we could risk institutionalizing things, have negative consequences for workers in their workplaces.
One of those potential consequences? Increased surveillance of employees that erodes their sense of privacy. Unlike cameras inside workplaces, density sensor doesn't identify individuals.
There's a fine line there, and you can still maintain people's safety without removing their privacy.
Density works with companies, universities, and other organizations to prevent too many people pooling in one place.
When maybe a bathroom is full and people shouldn't go in there yet, or things like elevator lobbies or places where people tend to congregate.
Technology as gatekeeper. It may be a trade-off many will come to accept. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.